The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With Nissan Subscribe and Drive. No deposit, no compromise, no fuss. Find out more at nissan.ie.
I'm joined now, delighted to say, by Richard Osman, known to many of you from his television appearances, Pointless, House of Games, and as well from his books. The Man Who Died Twice is in all good bookshops now, of course. Many of you will have read The Thursday Murder Club. Richard, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kieran. Lovely to be here.
Judging by social media, you're a fan of the place, are you?
Of Dublin?
Yeah.
The whole of Ireland, for sure. Do you know what? It's terrible. It's the only bit of Ireland I've been to, Dublin. Every time I come here, I mean to go further afield. But you tend to get sucked in to Dublin. It's quite hard to leave, isn't
it? Oh, yeah?
But at some point, I shall be up and around the country.
When you say sucked in, you mean you go to the pub in Dublin, is it?
Oh, yeah, sorry, what did I say? Sucked in, yeah. I meant having a drink, yeah.
Yeah, having a sup.
Yeah, yes, you're having a sup, yeah, there you go, absolutely.
Listen, I mentioned the books, The Man Who Died Twice. It looks like it's going to be as successful as the first.
Yeah, I mean, the first one took us all by surprise in terms of its success. I just thought I hope to sell enough that I can do another one. And then it went absolutely crazy. And so this one, it sort of felt like there was some pressure on it. And I thought, I hope people like it as much as the first one. But yeah, it sold even more, which is lovely. And people like it even more, which is more important. So it's been absolutely amazing. I'm very chuffed.
Can you give us the blurb for people out there?
Yeah, the first one. So the Thursday Murder Club is about four people who live in a retirement village. And once a week they meet up to look over old unsolved crimes. And then there's a real murder on their doorstep. So essentially you've got four sleuths in their 70s who are trying to solve murders. And in the second book, everyone who survives the first book returns, but I throw even more at them. Something happens in the first book which has very, very grave consequences in the second, and suddenly these four septuagenarians have even more on their hands. Essentially, they've got MI6, the mafia, drug cartels, all sorts going on in the second one. They have to try and decipher who did what to who. And why, like all good Agatha Christie-style whodunits.
Was that an inspiration for you, those Agatha Christie-style whodunits? Were you a fan?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a crime fiction writer. That's what I love to read, you know, and I love the best thing about crime fiction is that you set up a problem at the beginning and you solve it at the end. And in the meantime, you can sort of go on whatever journey you want. And so, you know, in this book, listen, you know there's a murder, you know we're going to solve it, and you just spend as much time as possible with these four great characters, and you know there's laughs in it and there's tears in it and what have you, and yeah, that whole world of crime fiction, that's why I love it, because you know you sort of roughly know where you are, but every writer takes you on a different journey. You know, your route is always completely unexpected and the characters you meet along the way are always unexpected, and that's I think the beauty of crime fiction.
And before you put pen to paper, I mean, what was the ambition or the vision for the book? What was it to write something like this, which is despite there being dead bodies in it,
yes,
you know, is a really warm story with these really warm characters that I think people find so endearing, yeah, you know, and they maybe project their own grannies and granddads, yes, onto them, yeah, whoever they might be. Or was it to be the kind of the John Connolly, there was blood and gore everywhere, and something much, much darker?
Well, honestly, a bit of both. I mean, I think I love the idea, and like in lots of TV things that I do, I like things to sort of wear the clothes of something rather cosy and warm. And for you to go, this charming, how lovely, how delightful, and make people feel welcome and, you know, welcome people in. But within that, I like to occasionally go a little bit darker. I like, you know, there's plenty of grief in the book. You know, there's plenty of sort of human emotions in there. So I'm not a huge fan of gore. You know, I'm not a huge fan of those sorts of... Oh, well, I love reading them, but it's not what I would write. I want it to feel warm, but as you get into it, you think, oh, okay, there's a little bit more going on under the bonnet here than I thought. And, you know, that's my favourite sort of thing. And as with telly, you know, I just try to write a book that I would love to read. It's all you can do, isn't it? Because, you know, then there's no cynicism. You're not ever having to second guess yourself. You just think, oh, well, is this still entertaining me? Are these characters entertaining me? But yeah, so it can, if you love a cozy crime story, you can read it as a cozy crime story. If you like a little bit of meat on your bones as well, then that's in there as well. There's sort of stuff there for everyone, I think.
Is it, when people describe the book as funny to you, how do you interpret that?
It's interesting that, because crime and humour don't massively go together. There's a few writers who can pull it off, but I really set out to not write a funny book. I really remember just giving myself a proper talking to and say, don't write a funny book, write a proper crime book like the ones you love to read. And there were no jokes in it at all. There's not a single one-liner in there. But the characters themselves, the four members of the Thursday Murder Club, were making me laugh so much with the way that the world was thrown at them and the way they reacted to things. And the fact that, like so many people in their 70s, they're sort of overlooked and they're underestimated and people think they're harmless. But, of course, we're inside their heads and we know they're not any of those things. We know how brilliant they are and how experienced they are. And constantly, when the real world was thrown at them, they were making me laugh. And I think when people say it's funny, I think the humour comes from character and comes from we really are cheering them on. And, you know, we love the way they get their own way in various ways. But there's not, I don't think there's a single one-liner in it. I don't think there is.
And in terms of those characters, and I don't expect you to tell everybody how the sausage is made, but, I mean, did you come to this with those characters fully formed and then, you moulded a murderer around them? Was it vice versa? I mean, where did they come from?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, once I'd had the idea of these four people living in this community and two sort of working class characters and two middle class characters, but all together, you know, so much I'm fascinated with class. As soon as I had the idea, the four of them, yeah, sort of emerged very, very quickly, I have to say. Joyce, who was a former nurse, slightly kind of based on my mum, maybe, and then Elizabeth is a former spy, and that was something I read a lot of, you know, spy non-fiction, Ben McIntyre's books and stuff like that. Mm. And I'm fascinated. There was always women in the background in the 50s and 60s and MI6, and I just thought, where would they be now? And Ron, you know, just a trades union activist, that just reminded me of virtually every member of my family. And then it's always good to have a psychiatrist, which is what Ibrahim is. And yeah, it's essentially, I know what the crime is, you know, I know where we're headed, but the four of them, because they approach everything from very different angles, they lead the story in all sorts of places. So I've got a beginning, I've got an end, but the story on the way is sort of as much of a surprise to me as it is to the readers.
If you're just tuning into The Hard Shoulder, Richard Osman, the author, is with me, and his new book, The Man Who Died Twice, is out now in all good independent bookshops as well, wherever you happen to be listening. You said there you're fascinated by class. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I grew up in the British working class, and now I'm very, very, very much in the British middle class. So I sort of think I've seen everything from every angle. And, you know, I find myself working in an industry, the television industry certainly, where for a long time I was slightly surrounded by people who I thought, I suspect if you'd gone to my school, you would not be in this job that you are doing. It's just a truth that doesn't speak its name anymore, you know. And, you know, we're so class-riven and, you know, I'm surrounded by lots of people who went to great public schools and are brilliant, by the way, and who deserve to be where they are and, you know, are hard workers and kind and smart. But when most people are somewhere in the middle, right? Most of us are mediocre. That's the truth of it. And if you're somewhere in the middle and went to my school, you will not achieve what someone who is in the middle and went to a very posh public school would do. You just won't. And that seems absurd to me that we still let that be okay. I find that extraordinary. And somewhere in that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, so for me as a human being, I find that difficult. As a writer, there's humour in it, and there's conflict in it, and there's all sorts of things. So I've always been obsessed with it.
But that ability or that inability to move between classes, is that something that, you know, you lament it hasn't changed? Has it gotten worse? Has it gotten any better in your lifetime?
Well, it's fascinating. The story of my family is the story of a huge amount of British and Irish families from the 20th century, which is the move from the working class, which you really couldn't get out of, sort of, you know, pre the Second World War. You stayed where you were born. A huge amount of social mobility post-war, and that happened with bits of my family, and other bits it didn't happen with. And so, you know, I've obviously benefited hugely from that. But it's a question now of how do we kickstart that again?
Yeah.
Because it does seem to have slightly kind of stopped. And the communities that used to be built, you know, weirdly, when people couldn't get out of the working class, those communities were so cohesive. And so, you know, they were extraordinary kind of breeding grounds for incredible people. And now, you know, we need to reconnect with big working class communities and work out how to, you know, give people all the opportunities.
I wonder, do you have a view on how you do it? I mean, education would have been the big driver of social mobility for a long time. Has that ceased to be the case?
Well, you know, I mean, listen, opportunity is the key, isn't it? That's all you can do is properly give people opportunities, you know. And I try and do things like I was just doing a scheme with the Old Bailey in the UK, trying to get kind of underprivileged kids into law and stuff like that. And there are lots of good schemes out there, but it just seems to have fallen off the agenda a little bit. You know, politically, that doesn't seem to be one of the big questions on the table in the way that perhaps it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Because, you know, and it's a shame because you're wasting so much talent and you're wasting so many brilliant people who'd be growing up, running businesses, you know, providing people with jobs, providing countries with their income tax. And it's, you know, it's a waste of a country's resources not to look after everyone.
It's an element of snobbery, is it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, even in the kind of TV and kind of books I do, there's a certain class of people who recognise that I'm not one of them, and who, you know, pull up the drawbridge and say, oh, well, people who watch this sort of stuff, you know, are idiots, you know. And it's the same group of people time and time again, and the message is always the same, which is you don't belong here. And that message is pervasive, you know. And if I get it, and I'm right in the heart of British popular culture, you know, and I still get it, and you'd think, God, for
people, I'm surprised to hear you get it.
Yeah, but of course, and you know, when I used to run a production company called Endemol, and we would bring new people in every year, and you know, all sorts of diversity targets, which I've always been a huge believer in, but I would always add a class diversity target as well, because that was very, very important to me. And you know, people who would, you have to move to London if you want to work in telly, so we'd make sure for the first 6 months that, you know, your rent was paid and, you know, you could afford to move to London and all these things which people don't, rich people don't think about, and people from the middle class people, they do not think about it. So I've always done, I was trying to walk it like I talk it, but, you know, we need that everywhere. It's the truth.
Yeah, I've one more question on this because I am fascinated by it myself before we move on. I mean, diversity inclusion is such a hot topic at the moment, and it's more than, I heard a great phrase, it's not about counting heads, it's about making heads count. But it's interesting you talk about a class target as well, because that's often not included.
Well, because it's hard to measure, right?
Yeah.
Gender is easier to measure, race is easier to measure, class is quite hard to measure. You know, my view always was, running a big company, that while everyone else was sort of going, oh no, it's got to just be best person for the job, no quotas, best person for the job, I was thinking, but your company
is pure meritocracy.
But their company is 80% men. You think, so at some point you've run a system where it's not the best person for the job, because that doesn't make sense. So I always made sure we tried to recruit, you know, as widely as possible. And it was the best thing about it is that I wasn't being PC. It was just enormously profitable for us. We were bringing in people, we were bringing in diverse voices, we were selling ideas that no other companies were having, because we were interviewing people from different communities, getting the best people, literally the best people. I always say with football, you know, if you want a new manager, if I'm Fulham, okay, I can probably get the 70th best male football manager in the world to come and manage Fulham. Or I could get the best female manager. Literally the number one best female manager there has ever been would come and manage Fulham. You think, do that.
Are you a Fulham fan? Is that what you mentioned?
I am,
Fulham.
I've been to
Craven Cottage, actually. I went to see them play Newcastle. God, it's about 15 years ago now. Great place.
Was it? Did we have Damien Duff back then?
No. And actually, you lost. Steed Malbronk scored
Newcastle. Yeah.
Quite a few bellies were on show after that Newcastle goal went in. Richard Osman is with me today on The Hard Shoulder. I mean, you mentioned the television shows Pointless and House of Games. And of course, that's how a lot of people listening to this, you know, will know you. The experience of them during the pandemic, I mean, they were on our screens consistently right throughout. Was there ever a point at which the plug was pulled, or no, did you have to scramble to keep them going?
Yeah, the first couple of months, we, like everyone, we absolutely pulled the plug on everything. And we had a bit of a backlog of programmes anyway. And then you get to the point where they say, well, look, you're allowed to go in and film again. You know, you're sort of a key worker, which of course is absurd, but obviously for me it was wonderful, because it's lovely to be able to go out and work. As you know, it's lovely to go and sit behind a microphone or in front of a camera. And so we went and filmed, and you know, that's a lot of livelihoods for a lot of people, and everyone was incredibly sensible. And since the start of the pandemic, I think we filmed 300 shows, and we haven't had a single day where we've had to cancel.
Since in 19 months or so, you've filmed 300 shows.
Yeah, because, you know, we go up and film five a day, and everyone is siloed. So if anyone, you know, is tested positive, their little bubble then kind of the next day has to sort of step down. But it's when the shows went out, I did think, oh, I'm so happy we did them, because people, it was so weird, just nothing new happening, no sport, nothing like that. And when we were able to put out like new episodes of House of Games, for example, people were genuinely saying thank you, because it's, it just feels like, oh, there's a bit of normality in the world. And, you know, we were craving normality so much. And to be able to do that was, I mean, I was very grateful to be working, but I was very grateful to be able to do something when so many people were doing incredible things and saving our lives and stuff like that. I was very glad I was able to go, well, look, here's something you can have. Honestly, take this and with my grateful thanks. But I was delighted to be able to do it. But yeah, 300 shows. I was, you know, we used to go up to Glasgow to film, and I'd be on a completely empty train carriage. And there's a bit of me now. I got to Glasgow and the carriage is full, and I'm like, oh, come on, this is, come on, who are all these people in my train?
This is maybe a silly question. Do you have to bring five different outfits then to fit in five shows in
you
a day?
You do, yeah. So on House of
Sorry,
Games
I'm fascinated because I was talking about this with Bake Off during the week, which is back on our screen.
Yeah.
They wear the same clothes the 2 days in a row, and apparently it's so that, you know, when they're editing it, they can put cutouts kind of
exactly
from both days together.
They can cut away and all that kind of, one of those clever tricks. So people do that, so they change clothes. But, you know, you'll sometimes get like a male contestant with very distinctive socks. And obviously you're not changing your socks. And people go, oh my God, I cannot believe you wore the same socks all week. That's absolutely outrageous.
Do you enjoy doing it? I mean, because it's to some people, they might think, 300 shows in that space of time or five in a day, there'd be an element of trudgery to it.
No, House of Games I love. House of Games, you do five a day, there's no audience, it's the same four people who are on the whole week, and to me it's like a, make sure it's like a dinner party and everyone's enjoying themselves, and you know, there's a soap opera element to it, and across the week people are getting more competitive, and that honestly is just having like a really good laugh with friends, and you know, people love coming on it, and I think it really, really comes across on screen, I think, and that's why House of Games has done so well. Pointless is, it's slightly different because it's a bit, because there's eight contestants and they're changing all the time, and there's usually an audience, and there's just there's a lot more technical stuff going on, so that's more of a job, and I love doing it, and I love working with Alexander, but House of Games is just fun from start to finish. Pointless occasionally feels like a job, but a job that I'm very, very grateful to have.
Yeah, and a lot of people grateful that you do it, I'm sure, who are listening to us. Listen, before I let you go, just on the book again, Steven Spielberg bought the rights to the first book or to all subsequent
he
books?
He bought the rights to the first book. That's a very good question. I assume he has the rights to the... I assume he has first refusal on the rights to the second one. Although, actually, I'm not sure he does, which is a fascinating thing. That's something I need to talk to my agent about. so he's got the rights. So they're writing at the moment, filming next spring, I think, is the plan. My God, that's incredibly exciting. You know, it's lovely when, you know, because I did think, oh, what if, you know, my publishers have only bought the book because I'm on telly? And then when Spielberg reads a book and goes, oh, this I really like, and you think, oh my, he just knows about story and warmth and character. And
have you met him?
No, it's because there's been a pandemic. So I don't know.
But he might say, God, Richard, I love Pointless. As soon as I heard,
exactly.
I had to find the rights.
Like, oh no, even you, Stephen.
How does that work? He takes the rights and goes off and does his own thing. Do you have any input?
Yeah, I'm an executive producer, but I've worked in telly long enough to know what executive producer means.
It is, as someone described once, it is to it is to real producing what the WWF is to Greco-Roman wrestling.
I mean, it really is. If ever you see executive producer on the end of a television show, run a mile. It's a vanity credit. So no, they're very kind. They say, look, any input you want, but I just say, honestly, get on with it. I'll get on with writing the books. I'll do my bit. You're the filmmaker, so you go and make the film. But yeah, I'll happily see the name executive producer and pretend I did something, but I didn't.
Yeah, but it'd be great to see it on screen. Isn't it one of those books, and I'm sure you get this all the time, and I'd be a cliche, people have very strong views, I'd imagine, on who should be cast.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, people get very excited about who should be in it, whether it's, you know, Helen Mirren or Julie Walters or, you know, Meryl Streep. We're trying to find out if Meryl Streep can do an English accent. I think it's going to be a nice gig for someone, that.
Yeah, nice few movies. Well, listen, Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure, and thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you.
The Man Who Died Twice, The Thursday Murder Book Club, Book 2 by Richard Osman, published by Viking. It is available in shops and online now. I've been lucky enough to read it already, and it is great. Richard, the very best of luck with it. Stay with us here on The Hard Shoulder. Back in a moment.